Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen here on KHOI Radio. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Priskintas.
And support for this very own Donalana Kitchen comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily 7 to 9, located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op. We all eat. We're all on this planet together. Let's take a moment to realize that we impact our Earth. Our actions affect other people. If you've been listening to the news, notice that there's an intersection between water and agriculture happening in this state. The city of Des Moines is bringing a lawsuit against three counties in northwestern Iowa. Because lots of things happen up in those northwestern counties that flow down through the Des Moines waterworks. So keep your ears to the news and what's happening, because the Des Moines utility wants to hold three counties responsible for the nitrates in their water. The Des Moines Waterworks plant is responsible for bringing clean drinking water to 500,000 residents in the Des Moines area. And they've had a real dickens of a problem dealing with the nitrates. And
I believe that it's the most heavily nitrated water in the U.S. Des Moines already has the largest nitrate processing facility of anywhere in the country, and they're still not able to deal with
it. They're trying their best. So instead of just putting a Band-Aid on the problem, they tried to go back upstream to find out what was going on. And they found that these three counties that were targeted under this lawsuit have...
They're Sac County, Calhoun County, and
Buena Vista County. There's lots of agriculture that goes on up there. We are a recipient of all their good things they grow. But there's almost 1.2 million hogs up there and a million turkeys and 96,000 cows.
These are confinement operations.
Yes, they are.
CAFOs, as they're called.
So there is a... reaction. There is all this nitrogen fertilizer, which does get spread around, becomes a problem when it leaks into streams and the rivers, and too much nitrates can be a health risk. And like Donna mentioned, the folks in Des Moines are trying their best, but they thought maybe to get these people to stand up and take notice, to get us all to stand up and take notice, there's a lawsuit going to be happening.
They're not suing the farmers. They're actually suing the counties for lack of enforcement of existing regulations. Is that what it is, Lana?
There are things they were supposed to be monitoring about what comes off these fields, and somehow it has not been working.
Right. It's not that they're even trying to change the laws. We do have laws on the books and some standards that they are not enforced.
So sometimes you have to start getting a little strident, because, yes, clean water is important to all of us. There's a quote here from Bill Stoy, who is the Des Moines Water Works CEO. He's been a real advocate for, guess what, clean water. What a good guy.
It's his job.
Yes, right. His quote says, "The state has chosen to turn its head from regulating these counties, and we're obviously at a point where we can no longer consider that to be a tenable outcome." So, let's see what happens with this. This is important, folks. This is our water. And it's our food system and our agricultural system that is intersecting with our need for clean water.
Yeah, and, you know, we've long known that it kind of goes down and into the Mississippi and then causes the dead zone in New Orleans, but that's someplace else, so we probably haven't done a very good job about it. But this is actually affecting our largest metropolitan area.
And like Donna mentioned,
not good.
And like Donna mentioned, this is a high concentration of nitrates, the highest in the country, actually. Other parts of the country are listening to this situation and finding out what's going to happen. This is important. It's important to acknowledge the need for clean water and get it
and
done.
And there are – it's not the poor farmers because, first of all, that's not poor. But also there are alternative ways of doing these things that can be more – yes, it will cost a little bit more money in the initiation of the farming practices. However, it will save money in the cleaning up of the waters.
Right. And
it's a little bit like preventative clean water or something.
What? That sounds like a good idea.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Preventing dirty water.
Right. And also actually bringing a lawsuit as opposed to just asking people nicely to do
this. I believe we've been asking nicely for
yes,
a long time.
We have
time.
Been. Our governor thinks that, according to what I've read recently, that we should just ask people to do all this voluntarily. We have been asking for a long time. Now is the time
We've had voluntary limitations for quite a while. Apparently, that doesn't always work when there's immediate cash flow involved.
Right. Things kind of get shoveled under the rug or actually pushed downstream.
Later.
Yeah. So
somebody else's problem.
So if you want to talk about this over your kitchen table, consider that clean water coming out of the tap. We shouldn't have to work so hard for clean water.
You know, remember that old musical Oklahoma where the ranchers and the farmers had to be friends? There's even a song about it. Do you remember that?
It doesn't come right to the brain right at the moment, I'm sure it's in there.
Oh, well, if I could sing, I'd just whistle it off for you. But it's an old dilemma, you know. Different farming techniques have different needs, and there has to be coordination and communication. And, you know, it's not that the Des Moines Water Works is trying to step on farmers' toes, but there has to be some kind of mitigation and balance here. It's gotten out of hand, apparently, according to the Des Moines Water Works.
So let's all take a good stand for some clean water for all of us.
In a democracy, I think the larger number of people has the upper hand usually.
Right. And this all goes on also down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
Those folks in New Orleans don't vote in Iowa, but in Des Moines –
they vote.
That's
they
right.
Vote.
That's right.
So talk to your legislatures, mm-hmm. folks. This is important. Take a moment to realize that we do impact things. Our actions affect other people. And let's consider our whole world. A good way to consider our whole world is to ask people what they eat. What's going on around their kitchen tables? Food can be our common language. We have a special guest today.
Yes. Today I've asked Beshak Bektaş to come. She is born in Turkey. She's lived in Ames for 8 years, and I've had the good fortune to eat a number of meals with Beshak, and she just does wonderful Turkish cooking, which is, I think, emblematic of a lot of all things Middle Eastern. And one of the reasons I wanted to have this discussion with her is because we're, you know, the growing cultural divide, which was represented in Paris recently in a most unfortunate way, means that we need to learn more about Muslim culture, Muslim eating habits, food, that sort of thing. So Beshak is going to explain to us some things that maybe not all of us know about Turkish food and specifically, but also about Middle Eastern food. I also brought in a book called Jerusalem, which is these are two young men who actually live in England now, and they have a very famous restaurant there called Ottolenghi. Here we go.
Good job, Donna.
Ottolenghi. And it's one of them Israeli and the other one is Palestinian. And they both grew up in Jerusalem. And they have three very hot cookbooks, which explain a lot of things about Middle Eastern food, which I've been trying to incorporate more and more. And actually some events that I have upcoming, I'm serving that kind of food so that we all expand our taste experiences. So, Beshak, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We were gonna talk about. Oh, she's not a culinary person, but she cooks really well. She's actually a transportation engineer and associate scientist at ISU. She's quite a talented woman here.
I need to correct. I try to cook really well.
Oh, okay.
But I eat
this
well.
Is this Turkish modesty?
Yeah, you never say you do well cooking. Like, you say, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Not really that good.
But you do eat well.
Yeah, but she does. She does very, very fine food. Plus, she has a 2-year-old son. So, of course, her mother has been here and done some cooking. And her mother-in-law has been here and done some cooking. Yeah. So we've had some really fine meals together.
Yes, always a pleasure. We also getting the chance to have Donna's really good food. And, yeah, maybe yesterday my son said, oh, yummy, for the soup I made. So maybe I can take a little compliment there. Because
yes,
they really,
that's right.
That really made my day.
Aurala's 2, right?
Yeah, he's 20 months now.
Oh,
yes.
Okay, he's coming on 2. And that child eats everything.
Yeah, so far he's been doing, I think we offer everything. Some days, you know, he won't try something or he won't like it as much. But many times he gives everything a chance. So that's all we can ask for.
And do you speak your native language at home?
Yes, at home we talk Turkish to him, and he responds with the little with few words that he has. He responds in both mostly, and he picks the easier version of something. For example, between turtle and kaplumbağa, he will go with turtle.
Wise choice.
And his father, Fatih, is an avid soccer player. So
yes.
Aral is already being held up to kick the soccer ball.
Yes, we have 3 to 4 balls in our living room, different sizes.
Time for a backyard. The boys are going to take
over.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I wanted to start by asking you maybe to explain, because we're coming into the Lenten season here for Christians. So maybe a comparison would be Ramadan. Can you explain what Ramadan is for Muslims and how it works?
I'll try to explain to you as somebody who always, like, saw this as a kid. And, I mean, my relationship with Ramadan, I used to fast. I don't anymore. So it's been a different
like,
progressing thing.
Yeah, it sounds like my relationship to Lent. But,
yeah.
But it is
I
a
think
cultural
there is,
thing.
To me, main thing is there is a religious aspect and there is a very big cultural aspect.
Right.
It's a big part of our culture. Even at times that I didn't fast, I would always go to opening of the fast at dinner time with my friends who fasted because it's a time we cook really good food and eat really good food.
Well, let's explain what it is. Let me see if I have
yes.
this right. You do not eat or drink between sunrise and sunset?
Yes.
And for how long?
For 30 days. 28?
28 days. Okay, so the Islamic calendar is not the same as the Christian calendar.
Yeah.
It's run by the moon.
It's the lunar calendar, which is, I think,
28.
12 days shorter than a solar calendar.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So the timing of Ramadan always changes because
mm-hmm.
every year it's 12 days earlier. Every year it's another time. So if you are fasting in summer versus winter is different because you have longer days in summer.
Oh, right.
You get thirsty more. So basically you don't intentionally take anything. It could be even smelling a dish. You cannot intentionally do that. But even like let's say you accidentally drank some water, then you would be okay because you did it by mistake.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
it's about the intention. It's the choice of
yes.
eating.
And what do children do? Is there an age where you need to follow the rules?
I mean, it needs to be when you're adult.
Mm-hmm.
It's a choice.
It counts as choice, mm-hmm.
yes.
of course.
So children don't have to observe that?
No.
And so, like, are restaurants closed during the day?
Not really, not everywhere and not all restaurants. It depends on kind of the city and how it's kind of a supply demand thing, you will. There are some cities where when you go, you could have difficulty finding an open restaurant, but there are a lot of cities where there are more crowded cities where you have a lot of people who are not really fasting, then you would have
well, and lots of cities in the Middle East have large Jewish and Christian populations as well. So probably serves them too. Now, so then what happens when the sun goes down?
When sun goes down, it's the dinner. We call it iftar.
And iftar.
Yeah. I mean, people have different ways of opening, like their fast. Olives are really typical. Dates are typical. Some would go for a glass
water.
Of water. Yeah. My father used to smoke a cigarette. I'm glad he no longer does that.
Oh, you can't smoke either during Ramadan.
No, you cannot.
Oh, you really, a lot of privation here. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
It really tests your will, doesn't it?
Well, and I'm sure the purpose is to concentrate your mind. What a good thing. And then every day you have an opportunity to turn back to your senses and eat something lovely.
And from my childhood, my you know really nice memories of this is like having 6, 7, 8 families all together, these big iftar dinners. And then it would be so much fun. We would stay there. And, you know, when I say dinner, think about side dishes of 8, 10. Starts with a soup. You have all these side dishes and salads.
A feast.
And then it's a feast.
Yeah.
It's a feast. And then
every night for 28 days?
I mean, you would not have the big family dinners with neighbors all the time, but even on a typical just your family iftar dinner would have a little something extra. There are things that are really available only that time of the year. For example, güllaç is a Turkish dessert. I think we have, it should be like rice starch sheets, if it makes sense. It looks like phyllo dough, but it's very fragile.
Ooh. So it's so, rice instead of wheat.
Yes. Uh-huh. And these sheets, you put some sugary milk with sugar mm-hmm. on, so that they get all moist. And you layer that with pistachios and walnuts. You put rose water.
So it's a little like baklava.
Yes. A little like baklava. So that's something very traditional to Ramadan time.
Mm-hmm.
There are different breads that are made for that time, like some tahini bread that you can find.
So what do? Stay up all night eating? I would probably stay up all night eating. And then what do you do just before the sun comes up so that you're ready for another day of fasting?
So that is called sahur. And, I mean, some do not wake up for sahur. Just have a little something extra before they go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
But some families wake up before sunrise and have kind of like a big breakfast with the family.
Oh, I was going to ask, what is a breakfast? What is a Turkish breakfast?
Turkish breakfast, there's a lot of bread. There's always Turkish black tea and olives, feta cheese.
How do you serve your tea?
We have a different way of making it.
Turkish black. So it's grown in Turkey?
Yeah, in North Turkey we have cities that grow tea. Rize is a big one. And then we have these two-pot kind of tea system where you have boiling water in a bigger pot under mm-hmm. and the tea part goes on top. Cool. And when you are serving, you serve a little bit of each because the top portion is a very dark black tea, if you will.
Wait, the top portion? So the...
So in the bottom pot, you only have boiling water.
Uh-huh.
On top, you put first the black tea leaves. Once your bottom pot starts boiling, you put some tea on top.
Dry tea?
Yeah, steeping the tea. But you do it kind of longer while you have that boiling water in the bottom.
So the tea leaves are just steaming? Or there's water in the upper pot, too?
There's water in the upper pot, too.
Oh, so it gets really strong because it has more heat coming up to
it. Yes, yes. Uh-huh. And then, I mean, people, of course, differ in their taste of how dark they would want. So mm-hmm. with this, you have the option. Because if you want a little tea, you want a light tea, you can put some from tap and mostly water.
Uh-huh. And do you drink it sweetened?
Depends on the person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is, I mean, you offer sugar with it. Some like it with a lot of sugar. And I think in
no milk, no lemon.
Lemon is not very common, but some prefer.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And I think in the South region, they have this special type of sugar that they called kutlama. It is like
kutlama?
A very... Yeah, it's a hard sugar that you keep in your mouth. And when you sip...
Is it white or brown?
I never saw it.
So you have the sugar, like, it's like a sugar cube in your mouth.
Yeah.
And you just suck on it while you drink the tea?
Yeah, and when you drink the hot tea, it, I think, draws more of that sugar.
What a good idea. Now, what about coffee? Turkish coffee is very...
Is that a breakfast thing?
Naturally, it's more like, it's something my mom and I used to do after breakfast, you know, like... If you had a breakfast 8 a.m. and then 10 a.m. you need a little something. It could be Turkish coffee.
So tell us how Turkish coffee is made. And what kind of coffee do you use?
At some person, I use both. But I think what makes Turkish coffee is the extra roasting. And it's very finely ground.
So could you use like a dark French roast or something?
I think so, if you...
So you just buy Turkish coffee?
I buy, and it's typically ground, ready ground.
Ah.
And then you make Turkish coffee in a special pot that is called cezve. And
what's it look like?
It looks like, I mean, it's a little pot with kind of an open mouth to mm-hmm. pour the coffee.
Okay, and so it has a pouring spout. And a long handle.
It has a long
handle.
And
it's very small, isn't it? About?
Depending, yeah, there are sizes. There's like, it's like an espresso maker. You have 2 shot, 4 shot, and so on.
So you're actually drinking it a shot. So it's kind of more like a shot of espresso is the volume you'd
It would be very similar, yes.
Okay, so you have this special pot. You put the coffee in, then what?
You first put the water in. You measure the amount of water with how many cups. Like how many people are going to have.
But you're drinking a small cup, more like a...
Yes.
Like
very
an
similar
espresso.
Very similar to like an espresso shot cup. And then you put the coffee.
So you boil the water, then you put...
No, it's still cold.
You
just put the cold water. You put, I mean, let's say a teaspoon to teaspoon and a half per person of that...
Of the coffee.
Coffee.
To say what, a quarter cup of water, half a cup?
That's per person. That's per one little teacup, coffee cup.
Okay.
And then,
so how much water to how much coffee?
So one little espresso cup of water.
So maybe a quarter cup of water to a teaspoon.
To teaspoon and a half.
Teaspoon and a half.
Put two.
Okay, of the ground. Okay, then what do you do with it?
Then if you're going to put sugar, you put sugar in it, and then you mix it. Mm. And then,
all cold?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then you put it on heat, but low heat.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs to be low heat for a longer time. That makes a good coffee, so that you would have froth on top.
Oh, so you let it go till it boils up a little bit?
Yes.
Oh.
And the moment it starts, you don't even go... Let it go until it boils because you want to get that froth from top. Put in your glasses, and then you let it boil a little more. Then you pour it on top, and
So you don't strain it.
You don't. You have that granules in the bottom. That's where all the Turkish fortune telling comes from.
Oh, so it's really an unstrained, slightly boiled coffee.
Yes.
What a very big difference. I mean, the French have a saying, something like bouillou foutu, which means if you boil the coffee, it's a failure. It's screwed, basically. This is Turkish coffee. Is this kind of, do they drink this all over the Middle East like this?
I think so. Most countries have some, I think by region, they don't call it always Turkish coffee.
Of course
Turkish
not.
Coffee is pretty general, I think.
So is the coffee grown in Turkey or is it coming from Africa?
Coming from other places, mm-hmm. yes. We just do the roasting and the drinking.
Well, I was in this book on Jerusalem. There's a wonderful old map where it shows Jerusalem, or which would be other parts of the Middle East, but the map shows Jerusalem as the center of the three continents of Europe, Asia, and Africa all come together and bring these wonderful influences. And, of course, I think a lot of the early trade also, everything must have gone through the Mediterranean, coming yes. either from Asia or up from Africa. So it is an old, old crossroads of civilization and many, many different
and
ingredients.
I think with the Ottoman Empire and like a lot of nations went through these soils and still live to this day. You know, we are a very varied culture.
Yes.
And once I saw this New York Times article, actually some friends of mine from Iowa State who are really into food sent me, because it was about Turkish cuisine and how it's talk about fusion cuisine, because it's there are so many effects of different cultures.
Yeah, the Jerusalem book talks about
for a long time
them
yes.
being that way also, and all the diasporas, and then the coming back together, and the moving through, and the
and we're so glad that food came and went and is still there.
Well, and then of course the whole area has this wonderful Mediterranean climate, which means
yes.
Common things are lots of citrus, lots of herbs,
sunshine,
and olives, and long growing seasons.
I want to take time to mention that this is KHOI 89.1. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We'll listen to a little bit of music here. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're here with Başak talking about Turkish food and good stuff that could be found from the Middle East. We've been talking about the fact that for so many centuries, all sorts of people have crisscrossed the Middle East, lived there, and everyone's got to eat. So when we sit down at a table, we can taste what's going on and share a lot besides just the food. We've talked about Turkish coffee and tea and Turkish breakfast, but there's lots more to talk about.
Well, I wanted to ask her about, was it the pomegranate molasses that your mother or you bring back from Turkey?
Yes.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Something very special, a homemade. Now, this is, you can buy pomegranate molasses, like at Pamel Grocery
yes.
and other, you can certainly order it online. And first of all, what is pomegranate molasses?
I think it's a very reduced pomegranate juice,
mm-hmm.
And I think there's the from the city where my mother gets it from, they kind of go through a sun drying process where they, I think that gets the really intense
flavor.
Okay, so
they open up the pomegranates and get those beautiful seeds and spread them out and dry them?
Not with the seed, the juice. It's more like the reduction of the juice.
Oh, how do you sun dry juice?
I think once it's, they kind of cook it over for a while and it's more like a syrup. They let it, that's something my mom always does with her jams actually. Once she makes them on the pot, she puts them in glass jars and puts like a cheesecloth on them so that it wouldn't get dusty or dirty. And then when they are usually at their summer place by the Mediterranean, you know, the sun is very generous. So
it's an aging process then.
It's it's kind of her preserving process. And then that jam, I can just leave it outside. Nothing happens really.
For how long?
For 2 years, maybe.
Oh my! See, a little differently than what we do here in Iowa. I don't think that'd work here.
Wow!
But we're talking.
Oh, because it's low humidity.
Low humidity, sunshine.
Oh. And how long do you leave it open before you cap it?
I think she goes 3-4 days.
And then you cap it.
Yes. Yes.
And then you can I've of course purchased pomegranate molasses, but the stuff that Bashak brought back was richer and I guess you have to go there to get it.
I always try to bring several bottles because I do things with it. I use it in salads, especially with fresh tomatoes. It makes a very good salad.
Right. How do you?
So I use basically all olive oil and pomegranate molasses together as dressing.
Just salt and any kind of pepper?
Salt, some peppers. That's about it.
What kind of peppers? That's a whole other issue.
With my dressing, I use traditional black peppers. But Turkey has a lot of different red peppers that they make chili peppers from. And Isot, which is also known as Urfa pepper, and Aleppo pepper are my favorites. Oh. Now, Aleppo is originally Syrian.
It's Syrian, right. I've cooked with Aleppo for years and years and years, and I really like it because it's not a high-heat pepper, but it gives you that broad pepper, like almost a slightly enhanced good roasted bell pepper. So you get that pepper flavor and a little heat, but not mouth searing. And then the Urfa, I discovered because of Bashak, when I saw this in the Zimmerman's catalog, I ordered some Urfa pepper. So they send you this little bottle for, normal spice bottle for $8 or something. And I whipped through that really, really fast. So I got online and I bought a whole pound of it because it's not strong and it's a beautiful dark color.
Spell Urfa.
U-R-F-A,
yes.
Right?
Urfa.
Here, stick your finger here and taste this, Lana.
This, Donna gave me some of this about half a year ago. And I tasted it. I thought, well, that's really good. And I actually, for the longest time, I've been calling it Donna's Greasy Turkish Pepper because it looks like coffee grounds. It looks like it has an oil on it. I don't know if it does, but it has kind of a sheen to it.
Oh yeah, it's really
so
pretty.
It looks kind of like seeds of some sort. Have a little sheen
it's
to
called, it. Is it smoked? It says it's. Is it smoked?
Yeah, I was looking up, so I guess there's a two-step process where that second step is they call sweating, that they, I think, let the peppers be in a contained space. And, you know, I don't know about the process that much in detail, but I think this difference in the way they process this pepper is what gives it that particular color and shiny.
It's a very kind of dark, a little purpley red, and the heat comes on slowly.
Yeah.
So what would one put that in? With what would you cook this?
I mean, if it would go on anything really, if you want, even salads. But very traditional thing is the kebabs that we have.
Oh. So is that lamb, chicken?
All. even some beef, but mostly lamb and chicken. And each region or city has their own kebabs. So Urfa would have, it has Urfa kebab, and I assume they would use more of isot or Urfa pepper in it, versus in other places you would find maybe more Aleppo pepper.
Well, and it's true, if you took a taste of Urfa and then you took a taste of Aleppo, there would be a difference in flavor and a slight difference in heat level too.
Yes, exactly.
And I will often, like, even if I'm making, for example, plain old American chili, and I want to up the heat without, like, putting a habanero in it or the Mexican things that you think, sometimes I will use either Aleppo or Urfa because it not only gives you heat, it gives you a certain flavor level, too, that I like. It's not just hot.
Yes.
So back to, I have a question about kebabs. As I understand it, the few times I've had it, does that mean things on a stick? Is that what a kebab is? Or can kebabs be anything?
I think anything, really, but the sticks are very traditional. So you have ground beef or lamb kebabs where they are on a stick.
So there's like, all these. Is that like making a meatball and then you put it on the stick and it doesn't fall off?
It doesn't, because the marination process is the main thing that makes a kebab, I think. Oh. For example, a neighbor of us, ours was, you know, he was very good at making these kebabs, and we would go on to picnics, and he would have these really nice lamb shish kebabs where they are lamb chunks, but he would marinate them for 2 days in onion and milk.
Onion and milk.
Which would, it would be like melting your mouth texture. It would be so soft. That's something I
cow
learned
milk?
From him.
What kind of milk do you have? Goat milk more?
Mostly cows.
Cow's milk. Okay.
Yeah, that's something I use. Also yogurt for marination. Yeah, I use, for example, yogurt with Aleppo pepper and some garlic with lemon slices. That's one of my marinades for chicken kebabs.
So you just put that all together and leave it in the refrigerator for a couple of days?
With chicken, a day is enough. With lamb and beef, longer works better, I experienced.
And I want to know where the pomegranate molasses comes back in. What else do you do with it? And you also mentioned grape molasses.
Grape molasses is more, I mean, we use it more as a jam. For example, when I was growing up, grape molasses with tahini mixed together was one of my favorite
snacks.
It's like
peanut butter and jelly.
Yes. I mean, it would be always on the kitchen table, and you dig in with a little bit bread.
So what makes it molasses? Because it's just a... So if you took Concord grape jelly and you boiled, and reduced, would you end up with grape molasses? Or would it be a different kind of grape, maybe?
I guess you would still end up with molasses. Actually, I was lucky to experience how they made mulberry molasses when I was visiting my mother-in-law in Turkey. So they, maybe 5-6 ladies in the neighborhood, they got together, and they live in a region where they grow hazelnuts, and they have all these gorgeous fruit trees. So they got all the mulberry together, and they built a wood fire. And on that, they basically boiled and boiled the mulberries until they ended up with a thick syrup.
So,
I mean,
does it leave the seeds in, or you crush it first?
They sieve it in the end.
Oh, in the end. Wow, not in the beginning. Okay.
I think anything would just stay up, basically.
And these are the dark mulberries.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so they don't add sugar. They don't add anything except mulberries. And it's boiled over an open fire.
Yeah. And I usually try to find it here, because when my mother-in-law came to visit, she brought some. Because she either makes it or buys this from a particular person.
Who has made it, probably.
Because when I buy here, it's not as dense, not as flavorful as many things are. So my son really likes it with yogurt, actually. He likes that little bit sweetness. So that's how we get him to eat a jar of yogurt most days.
And what kind of yogurt? Do you make your own? Do you?
We make our own now with the little one.
Have you been using my kefir culture?
Not yet. We need to get into it.
Oh, it's easier than yogurt. And it's easier because you don't have to have such a temperature control on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll get you one of the shots.
Okay.
And do you thicken, do you do like Greek yogurt? Is that common in Turkey too, where you strain it down or you just eat?
Yeah, it's, we call it strained yogurt. For some recipes, you would need denser yogurt. So I, for example, have my kind of yogurt cloth that I sometimes use to strain.
Is that like a cheesecloth?
Exactly.
Yeah. And then, okay, we got to talk about tahini too, because that's another, that's like the peanut butter of the Middle East, I believe.
Yeah, it's a very common ingredient. So something very maybe familiar to people would be baba ganoush. It's eggplant with tahini and garlic and other spices. Again,
hummus has a lot of tahini.
Hummus
in it too.
Is basically chickpeas and tahini, and it's
and lemon and
again garlic. Aleppo pepper I put in.
Oh, me too. And I put
lemon juice.
I put preserved lemons in my tahini. We talked about preserved lemons last week. So
and tahini is ground up
sesame seeds.
That's what gives it that wonderful flavor.
Now, there are colors of sesame seeds, right? So the tahini is the light sesame seed. There's black sesame seed and blonde.
Isn't the color based on whether they are kind of roasted or
not?
Oh,
maybe. Maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just have read recipes and they'll say, sprinkle with a mixture of black and light sesame seeds. It's a color thing or something.
Yeah. Talk more about baba ganoush. What baba ganoush? There must be 20 different ways to spell that, but it all tastes good. So baba ganoush is a good way to eat eggplants. It's probably the way I learned to eat eggplants, and it's not something I grew up with. It's a nice thing. Do you start it with an eggplant? Do you roast, cook, boiled, or eggplant?
Roast. I think roast gives that nice smoky taste.
Right, concentrates the flavor.
Usually, in summer, I try to buy when it's fresh and available, freeze and store in the freezer.
You freeze the eggplant fresh?
Yes, not fresh.
After so you just cook?
Smoked and cooked, especially in a grill. Uh-huh. I will just put it in a bag, like a nylon bag.
Do you scrape it out of the skin before you freeze it?
Yes.
Yeah. So baba ganoush is basically some kind of roasted. You cut the eggplant in half. You lay it open. I've actually failed to cut my eggplants in half and had them explode in the oven.
Don't do that.
Dumb. So you cut it in half and lay it face up and roast it till it's quite soft. And then you scrape it out of the skin. And then you kind of have roasted eggplant pulp.
Yes. And to that you would add garlic and...
So you freeze it just at the pulp stage.
Yes.
Good preservation technique, Lana. We might have to do that if we have a good eggplant year next year.
Yeah, so when you have, you know, you have dinner.
And are these just the typical black to dark purple eggplants?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the round and big ones would make, nice amount of pulp.
Mm-hmm.
With the kind of Japanese-style thin eggplants, I prefer making some kebabs.
Right.
And that's something I use the molasses for, pomegranate molasses for, sometimes for like a sour, garlicky dish. You basically cut that eggplant, long, thin eggplant, like every inch or so, and you put some meatballs, basically, like from kebab mixture that you make in between. You put them in a pot.
Oh, so you're putting them in a skewer?
No, not really. I just place them in like a casserole dish or a pot.
Okay.
Put the meatballs between them and then put some tomato, ground tomatoes, pomegranate molasses, ground garlic.
Fresh.
Olive juice, yeah, fresh, and just cook.
Olive juice?
Olive oil. Sorry.
Oh, not juice. Okay. I was imagining the juice from the can.
Juice.
Okay,
yeah.
No. And then you put a lid on it and cook it on stovetop or oven?
Sometimes both works.
Oh, you can fight me over for that.
That sounds like a good potluck dish. That's very
now,
good.
Here's another thing that's very Middle Eastern that I don't deal with very much is phyllo dough.
Yes. It's one of my favorites because we have both savory and sweet dishes, like desserts and savory things.
Where do you buy your phyllo dough?
I buy sometimes at Pamel of the very thin...
It's frozen, right?
Frozen phyllo dough you can find at Hy-Vee. Many stores have it. But there is a thicker version we call yufka that I usually buy online.
Yufka? A thicker version. Maybe I can handle the thicker version. Is it less difficult to handle?
It's less difficult to handle, and the phyllo dough itself is very... I mean, you see it more in like spanakopita. You know, Greeks.
Which is a cheese and spinach layers into, like feta cheese and spinach layered and then roasted. Spanakopita.
Yeah, we have, for example, spanaklı börek, which probably means the same thing, a similar process. And baklava is the main dish. The phyllo dough is used.
So even in Turkey, people buy their phyllo dough.
They do, but when I was growing up, we used to have this phyllo dough shop. So this guy would basically make fresh phyllo dough all day
long.
For
everybody.
Yes.
Oh, that must be a fun thing to watch.
You're listening. So wonderful.
You're listening to KHOI Radio. We're here with Başak talking about good food.
Başak Bektaş.
Başak Bektaş. Phyllo dough, eggplants. And here's some music by a band called Wild Asparagus. Welcome back to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're here on KHOI Radio. This is community radio. Support this community radio station. Be a member. Go to khoifm.org. That's the website. Find out all about us there. And notice, find the donate button. The donate button is a real fine thing to push. Support us with that donate button. And you can also find the Donna Lana Kitchen website. On that web page too, you can find past shows, you can find recipes, and find a dandy picture of Donna and I. You've been listening to the music of Wild Asparagus. We'll take a short minute to mention that there is a Central Iowa Barn Dance coming up this weekend.
Saturday night,
the 24th, 8 o'clock, at the Collegiate Wesley Annex, 130 South Sheldon Avenue. Come and dance, live music, lively caller. It will teach you everything you need to know. That's Saturday at 8 p.m. So, back to more good things. We have lots of food to talk about yet.
Maybe we should find out about Middle Eastern dancing. I think there is a belly dancing teacher. Yeah. Well, one thing I have to say about Middle Eastern cuisine all out is, at least in my perception, it does eat a lot of vegetables.
Yes.
Lots more vegetables, kind of more smaller portions of meat. And what about pickled vegetables?
We have a lot of pickles, and actually we have pickle shops that sell nothing but pickles. And, I mean, some pickles that may be interesting for people. Eggplant pickles are some of my favorites.
Now, are these brined pickles or vinegared or all kinds?
I mean, there are some salt and vinegar pickles. There are some salt lemon juice pickles, which are my favorite. I really like the lemon juice variety, especially for cucumber pickles.
Uh-huh. Well, so what's an eggplant pickle?
An eggplant pickle, I think that there's a little boiling of eggplant before it goes in a brine, but...
Salt brine?
Salt brine.
No vinegar.
I think that's also... It might be both. It might be just salt and vinegar. Our neighbor used to do this salt vinegar pickles with lots of garlic, and should also sometimes get the pulp of the eggplant out inside and use this eggplant shell for a pickle of peppers, onions. So it's like a stuffed pickle.
Oh.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine.
We sometimes go fancy
pickle.
With our pickles.
Yeah. That sounds, yeah. Like, that sounds good.
Beet pickles.
Mm-hmm.
Even onion pickles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, even the British do pickled onions.
Oh, how nice. How nice.
And, of course, I suppose the usual cucumbers.
Yeah, a lot of varieties of cucumbers. There's one called Çengelköy cucumber, which is from Istanbul region. This size would not mean much to the listeners, but let's say 5 to 6 inches mm-hmm. and less than an inch thickness, maybe half an inch. And
oh, so these are more like what we grow some around like that called, and they're usually called Persian cucumbers
Or
something like that. They're small and delicate and have very thin skin. Is that the
skin?
Yeah,
and they make
so you leave the skin on.
Yes, yes.
Even and then you pickle them mm-hmm. whole.
Whole, typically whole. And another thing is with tomato pickles, it's usually they pick the tomatoes when they are green, so that maybe they are not as delicate.
Yeah.
So they make a really tasty pickle.
A green
as
tomato
well.
Pickle. Well, that might be a useful recipe here at the end of some of our seasons.
Oh, that sounds like lots of different things to eat here. Thank you for joining us today, Bashak. This is wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, yes. Now I'm hungry for all these good tastes, and it makes me feel warm all over. Yes, yes. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Nartigal.
And Donna Prisgintas.
With special guest, Bashak Bektaş, telling us about food from Turkey. Yes. We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Go to khoifm.org. Support this radio station. Talk to your neighbor. Share a recipe. Learn new things. And this weekend, the PFI convention is going on here. PFI conference. It's Friday and Saturday. Mapping Our Future. To find out more about that.
And there's also a performance of Mary Swander's Map of My Kingdom Friday nights at the Schumann Center. I don't know, what time? 5 or something like that?
Go to practicalfarmers.org for more of that information. So talk to your neighbor. Share a recipe. Learn new things. We're all in this together. Eat good food and enjoy life.